Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm extraordinarily overwhelmed because I have Joy Williams here with me, one of my very favorite writers, about her book of short stories, new and collected. It's called The Visiting Privilege. It's published by Knopf. There are 33 of the old stories from three books that were published before and 13 new ones. But my feeling about her is sort of, it comes from before knowledge. It's when I read her stories, they take me to places that I didn't know could be gotten to. And so as a result, I feel more intimate with her than I do with many other writers. I thought, so that people would have an idea of what they're in for, we would first hear you read a story called Souvenir. And I think it's an extraordinary story. Now, many of her stories are somewhat spooky, and in this case, she takes her characters to Cornwall, which is famous for ghost stories. They are tourists, and they even compare the ghost stories of Cornwall to the ghost stories of Wales. Now, these people then really need to be treated to something ghostly, and they are. This is Joy Williams reading Souvenir.
This is in England, in Cornwall, and a more weird, dreary spot could scarcely be imagined. Nevertheless, tourists were beginning to arrive in ever-increasing numbers because they had been everywhere else. The inhabitants of the place were in many respects peculiar, poor and cruel, with extraordinary dark eyebrows, but the cream teas were excellent, the dogs were polite, the gulls were big, the crows enormous. The weather was foul. The graveyards weren't as full or as mossy as those in Wales, the lanes not as snug, the cooking not as delightful, few turnips, no leeks. Actually, the dogs, though courteous, didn't work as hard as the dogs of Wales. The ones without heads were the devil's dogs. Even the most unobservant tourists had no problem in identifying them. Most of the ghost stories in Cornwall involved ships and drowned sailors. And these drowned people, these ghosts, were always coming back to harass the living, or to drag a beloved into the grave with them. Sometimes they came back to smile at their mums. The stories were a little tiresome. In the old days, ships were always going down. The people on land liked it best when fruit ships went down. Oranges floated in, grapefruit. In King Arthur's town, there was a big run-down hotel on a cliff. The drinking room there was called the Excalibar. It was for tourists. The locals wouldn't be caught dead in the place. A group of travelers were sitting this night in the Excalibar, drinking Adios Amigos, gin, brandy, white rum, red vermouth, bit of lemon juice, shake and stir. A frightful storm lashed the windows. The locals were in the chapel eating pancakes because it was Shrove Tuesday. In a few hours, Lent would commence. The locals didn't care for the tourists, never had. As for the tourists, they were beginning to believe what they'd been told, that Cornish culture was nothing but ghost stories and meat pies. Not that they were here for culture. They were here for a bit of the odd, a bit of the creepy. There were 7 species of seagulls in the area. That was somewhat creepy. And a village called Lizard, an odd name indeed. The locals had polished off their pancakes and were tidying up, preparing to play their Lenten prank. This year it fell to Paul and Paul, 2 old men. They staggered out of the chapel into the windy, rainy night and tottered along the cliff road to the Excalibur. The travelers had stopped drinking Adios Amigos and were now experimenting with sheep dip, gin, sherry, and strong sweet cider, stir and strain. There were 2 boy hikers, several married pairs, 3 ladies from Ohio, a transvestite, and a French couple who sat apart, quite aware that the others were thinking, the French eat horses, but they don't eat corn. The transvestite was having a quiet holiday alone, if you could say that a transvestite was ever quite alone. The imagination it takes to be one, it must be exhausting. She was dressed sensibly, sensible shoes. Paul and Paul lurched, dripping, into the revelers' midst. They both had suffered strokes in the past. One hand on each was cold and crabbed. Their eyes were bulging and clouded. They weren't going to tell any scary stories, not these 2. Weren't going to tell this crowd about the vanishing hitchhiker or the man with half a face, or the ones about the boiled baby's revenge and the body of water that likes to break little boys' backs. They were just going to play a few games, give these tourists something to remember. What did they think life was, a vacation? The travelers had been playing a game of sorts before the old buzzard's arrival. They were secretly assigning zoomorphs to everyone present. Of course, privately, they all thought of themselves as cheetahs. There was not a single exception to this. Paul and Paul had wide, rotting smiles. Once they had been young and vigorous, clever, handsome, their lives before them. But they'd had to give it all up. It seemed to have been the deal that had been struck at birth. The tourists made an effort to find them engaging. They so terribly wanted to be amused. They bought them beverages, having moved from sheep dip to blimlets to blue skies by then. Blue skies are gin, lemon juice, a dash of unflavored food coloring, and half a maraschino cherry, if available. After a few blue skies, it was clear to all that the 2 Pauls were the cabaret. It all began innocently enough. They proceeded to engage their audience. Each among them had to confess to a loss. "I lost my skill at baking cakes," one of them ventured. "I lost a rucksack once, a ring, my hair, my trigger finger." The fellow raised his hand, and it was true. It was maimed. There was no trigger finger. "My beech trees outside Lyon, every one. My driving privileges, my husband." It was amusing how this had slipped in there, and they chuckled. "My memory." They howled at this one. "It's true. Can't remember. Get everything mixed up. You never know when the last time for anything might come. Now we're cooking," one of the Pauls cried. "My breast. My potency, my beloved Skippy." Time began to tear through there. Inside, their lives were passing as though in a single night. They longed for a nice teeny tiny, you know, of the give me my bone sort. For a spectral bridegroom or a brain on a stick, even a vampire or a cannibal. Anything but this deathly entertainment, these dreadful drinks, these hideous old gentlemen, whom they were feeling more and more indebted and attached to. These Pauls, urging them on to even greater and more fearful acts of admission to loss. The time passing, the blackness pressing against the greasy windows, and the morning that had always come, delayed.
Joy Williams reading her story, Souvenir. That story really scares me silly, because it suggests that while ghost stories may be scary, the truth is unbearable. And these Pauls lead these tourists who are expecting to have a campy good ghost story time to tell the truth. The truths about the things they've lost. And on top of it, the story's title tells us to regard these lost things as souvenirs. Scarier still, because the thing you've lost will always be with you. My breast, my potency. How do you, in this particular case, get there to a story that goes so deep and so close to what people don't want to tell and redefines chills?
Well, I'm not sure if I could describe how I got there, but I was very interested in something you said earlier about a story taking you to a place where you didn't think you could go, or you certainly didn't think a story could take you. And I think that's what short stories, good short stories, have always done, but are doing to a lesser extent, perhaps, these days. I mean, the levels beneath the clamor of our days is what I think the story deals with. And in this case, it's odd that you asked me to read that, because I don't think I've ever read that story before. And it almost seemed to me like a little fragment of something. In other words, I couldn't really, I would ruin that piece if I really tried to follow any of the tourists but I can imagine another writer almost taking it from, or any number of writers. You could have a whole collection of stories about people that are talking about telling ghost stories in Cornwall on a stormy night. And each contemporary writer would come from a different direction and, hammer their own nails.
I found myself thinking, Joy Williams presents often two versions of ways to see life. One of them is conventionally magical. You have a story called Escapes, in which a mother who remembers Houdini takes her daughter to a terrible magic show. But then there's a different kind of magic and a different kind of escape. The girl has to escape the life her mother has provided for her. The mother is sort of between wacky and crazy, interrupts the magic show, wants to see real magic. And the story, just like this one, Souvenir, shows us what real magic could be if it were available to us. It's not human. It may, in fact, be inhuman. And it seems to me that the choosing between magic or between realities is what your stories do. Does that make sense to you at all?
Oh, I love to hear you describe the stories. Again, I'm not very big on describing structure or how I came to write any of these stories in an organized way. I guess I'm superstitious about it. I'm incapable of it, as well as probably being, if I could do it, I would be superstitious about it. But I think our life is so full of terror and horror. I mean, we die, we lose our children, we lose our parents, we lose, life is full of horrible things, and yet we seldom really address it until we're banged into the basement or something and glimpse it for a moment. And I think some of the characters in my stories, or maybe this is what I'm trying to do in the stories, is show that subterranean river that the characters sometimes get a glimpse of to their dismay before they, you know, turn and blink and rattle off on something sort of irrelevant or ordinary. You know, a lot of our life is spent in evasive maneuvers, isn't it? And yes, loss. That's what we have.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Joy Williams about her book, The Visiting Privilege, New and Collected Stories. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with my beloved Joy Williams about her latest book, The Visiting Privilege. They're new and selected stories. It's her first publication in 10 years, and this is a book of 43 short stories spotlighting her astonishing and inexplicable, effortless style. You know that these stories were worked and worked, but by the time they're done, someone once described the dancer Gwen Verdon as moving like spun spit.
Spun spit.
It's amazing. Yeah, and I thought, yeah, when you come to a moment in these stories, suddenly you're at a place where everything is participating in the effect except an explanation of how it was achieved. What do you think about magic?
Well, it's not magic. I don't think magic can happen to the writer when he's writing. I mean, there isn't this wonderful magician that suddenly... But I think you can open yourself to... put yourself in some sort of state to receive. And I'm using this in an almost religious way. To receive some sort of comprehension, vague as it may be, that shapes the story and can even end it. I don't revise my stories. I write them very slowly, and I revise as I go along. But I've never been the kind of writer that can really go back to a story and dig around in it and alter it in a big way. That's probably why I'm not much use in university workshops, because, of course, that depends so thoroughly on revision.
I'm curious. You worked with a writer that most people have forgotten when you were at the University of Iowa, R.V. Cassell?
Cassell, yes. Cassell. R.V. Cassell. He was a wonderful, wonderful teacher.
And I thought he was kind of a wonderful writer.
Yeah.
He's completely forgotten, but I have most of his books. They're strange and beautiful, kind of unaccountable, not entirely successful, but he tried again and again to write a book that would be ineffable in some way that didn't precede him.
His big book, his novel was Clem Anderson, a novel called yes. Clem Anderson.
I know that several of the writers I've had on the show, like Michael Carroll, or Tao Lin, they refer to you as one of their major influences.
I'm flattered. but, you know, but I read their work, and they don't seem at all like me, which is even better that I've managed to influence them, and yet they utterly are not doing what I'm doing and have their own vivid voice.
So when you were there in Iowa doing what you were doing, what were the responses like?
Well, in those days, you didn't put your name on the manuscript. But, of course, everyone knew who was being discussed that week. And I was the only woman in the class. I think at one point another woman was involved, but I can't remember who she was, or I don't know if she really wanted to be a writer. They were very kind to me. I think I was younger. I went to school with Andre Debuse and, you know, Jim Whitehead. They had families. They were very grown up, and I wasn't. I wrote a story that's a ghost story called The Rumor that has never made the cut in any of the collections, and it didn't make the cut here either. And I wrote about, you know, spending a summer with my grandmother in Plymouth, Pennsylvania, in the coal mine district, where there were outhouses behind each of the little houses. Just, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was encouraged by the boys, the men, certainly. I remember giving one story when I was up 1 week. I didn't double space because I thought it looked more professional. I thought it looked as though it had been published. And the only comment Castle put on that was, double space you. Didn't even bother to, you know, teach me with that one.
So you were more or less allowed to develop without people saying, you weirdo, how do you do it?
Oh, no. No, were they more polite back then, do you think? All this? I mean...
I don't know what it was, but, you know, your fiction is some of the weirdest, I don't need to add, and most beautiful that I know. Do you think that maybe being the only woman led to a kind of old-fashioned 50s style
maybe
politeness?
I mean, you know, I don't think I'm that weird. You know, that has come up before. I have to tell you a funny anecdote. See what you think about this.
Yes.
When I reviewed Brad Gooch's book on Flannery O'Connor, his biography of Flannery O'Connor for the Times, I mentioned that she was peculiar. Flannery was peculiar. Does that seem outrageous to you?
No.
Okay. Joyce Carol Oates wrote a letter to the Times complaining about my use of the word peculiar and how just this was not proper to. I mean, this was really demeaning and diminishing, and I shouldn't have used that word, and I should have been prevented. I mean, Flannery's peculiar. Joyce Carol Oates is peculiar. I'm peculiar. But I've never thought of that I have a particularly weird outlook or style. But
there are writers that I do consider strange. I consider our beloved Christina Stead, The Man Who Loved Children. By the time you're in the depths of it and Lulu is telling a story about a monster, and we can read by that point everything she is not saying into this extraordinary story told in extraordinary fairy tale language. She's weird. When Jane Bowles writes...
Another huge favorite of mine.
Yeah. She's not?
Enormous favorite of mine, of course.
Enormous favorite. When she writes about women in Mexico who innocently find themselves prostitutes, and you get the feeling it's not just the character who doesn't know what prostitution is, it's the writer. And the effect is so giddy and spooky. I kind of want to say, well, pardon me, implicitly Joy Williams is in this gang. And I want to say that you can never exactly say how the astonishing effect is achieved. I think in Joy Williams, it's a very weird attitude toward truth-telling. Nothing but the truth will suffice, but the only truth worth telling is the truth that people have a terrible hard time with.
Expressing. Right.
Yes. And then it's as if the writer, the narration, waves a wand and the characters are able to say things briefly that no one has ever said before, that are so extraordinary that the story is, pardon me, weird.
Well, you're extremely articulate. I'm not an articulate person, so, and I only wish I had a wand, but my characters can just say wonderful, wonderful, outrageous, thoughtful, sort of super realistic, God-given pronouncements, and then they sink back into ordinary life, as it were.
It's as if the experience around them has shaped them for a moment to being able to speak a poem. Mm-hmm. They're poets for a second. They rise to a greatness, to a transcendence. It's an imprecation. It's often incantatory. And it's like inspiration, being struck by the inexpressible wonder of life. And nothing short of that seems to be satisfactory to you.
No. No, that's, well, why write a story where illumination doesn't, it's false illumination sometimes, I'm sure. It doesn't really resolve the story, or it doesn't
doesn't
shape the story. But there are, but it's glorious for an instant.
I've been talking with Joy Williams, the creator of many glorious instants in her collection of new and selected stories, 44 of them. You'll never forget them. After you've read this book, you can go and read her novels, which are also extraordinary in a quite different way. But I promise, you'll never forget her. The Visiting Privilege is the book. It's published by Knopf. Thank you, Joy, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael, so much for having me here.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Mary Carr is our guest.